Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Stuart Boyne, Global Head of HR at Argo Group International Holdings.
To start things off, let's get kind of an introduction, a little bit of kind of your background and how you even were ever brave enough to get involved in this space in the first place.
So my background is slightly unusual, I suppose, when it comes to being in HR. So I left university in 1992 and decided at that time that I'd like to pursue a career in the army. So I went and applied to join the military, went to Sandhurst, the military academy, in 1993 and was commissioned in 1994. And I think the reason why I joined the army is a little bit about why I love doing what I do in HR. And that is that I grew up in a military family and I really witnessed firsthand how fantastic soldiers can be. You know, they can be challenging, like any individual, and there could be, you know, there's notoriety around, you know, being a soldier in terms of how they behave and that sort of stuff. But they are the salt of the earth. If you give them something and you care about them, they give it to you back in bucket loads and spades. And I knew that from a very, very early age, and that's sort of what drove me into being in the army. It wasn't about guns and walls and stuff. It was about the opportunity to be with and to lead soldiers. And I was very lucky in my career. I served for 10 years and did a couple of operational tours into Bosnia and to Kosovo, and really got a chance to lead soldiers on operations. And it is a very rewarding it's a very rewarding career and a huge amount of fun, a lot of excitement, dangerous, obviously, but you get a huge amount back and you learn a lot about what makes people tick, you know, why people do things, especially in operational scenarios when, you know, lives are on the line and, you know, a bad decision can mean a, you know, the difference between life and death. You get to understand what makes people tick and why they do things. And it was that when I chose to leave the army in 2003, that sort of guided me into the path of HR. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with my second career, but I knew that I wanted to be involved with people. And you know, I was a bit late to start thinking about, you know, do I want to be a stockbroker or do I want to be a marketing specialist or something that would probably require you to, you know, start your learning, you know, in your early 20s, you know, post school, post university. You know, the knowledge of the people that I had built over those 10 years sort of allowed me to sort of parachute in a way into HR. And that was my route in, and I was very lucky. I got a good break, and I met somebody that was just in the process of starting up a company, and they wanted some help. And he asked me if I wanted to do 3 days a week on a contract to come in and do some filing and some paperwork. And I didn't have a job, so I said yes. And you know, 15 years later, I'm the head of HR for a global insurance company. So that's my story.
Fantastic. And I think that the experience in the army has got to be such a unique one. And I'd love to kind of learn a little bit more about kind of that and the influences that that had on kind of later down in your career when you would look at different behaviors. The initial thought for me was that when you look at civilians and the way they interact in the workplace, if you like, was that ever kind of a frustrating one? Because soldiers were this kind of discipline. Well, they were very disciplined. And then when you came out, the behaviors were so different. So even though I think that, like, you know, your handling of people, you got that experience from the army, I'd be curious to know whether it was, you know, it was quite a frustrating kind of transition into kind of a civilian way of thinking and that absolute dealing with people who weren't absolutely willing to die for the corporation, if you like, and whether that was kind of a transition, something you saw, or whether, you know, it was pretty comparable.
So it makes me laugh because people always think that the military is really disciplined and soldiers are really disciplined, and ironically, they're not really. The structures, what the army has that civilian organizations don't necessarily have, is a really robust structure that's been built up over many, you know, many decades, many hundreds of years. And it has a fixed set of processes that are proven and work that everybody follows. Now, that doesn't, you know, so that means that there are, you know, there are certain rules and regulations that you follow, but also allows you to then think differently, or differently is not necessarily the right word, but you can think in a way that gives you freedom, because you have a freedom to operate around this military framework. And as long as you stay within the framework, you can operate in whatever way you like. But that also then allows you to push that authority and that decision making to a very low level, because everybody works within the same framework and it's built up in that way. And I think so that's there's a difference. And I'll come back to that in a second. The discipline around the soldiers, people are people, right? They are the same as people in civilian companies. I've come across disruptive people in civilian companies as much as I've come across disruptive people in the military. And the same way, I've come across people that are extremely studious and hardworking and very disciplined in the military, in exactly the same way people in civilian life think about their careers, and they're very hardworking and studious and doing exams and qualifications and all sorts. So I think people are people. It's comparable. I think where my frustration came out a little bit, I'm not sure it was necessarily frustration, but I think certainly my observations about how different it was go back to my previous point, which is around how you have this operational framework. And that allows you to work very effectively and very efficiently. Whereas I find that certain civilian organizations that I've certainly been part of, that framework doesn't necessarily exist. So a lot of the control and the power, ironically, is held at the top. Whereas you think in the military, a lot of power should be at the top. You know, the generals and the brigadiers and the officers all have the control and the power, and the soldiers do what they're told. Actually, that is really not the case in the military, but is much more the case in civilian life, because that willingness to push power down, push control down, push decision making down, is much less available within a civilian organization, because you don't have that framework. In the military, you do. So actually, that's a huge difference, which then makes, in a way, can make the military very efficient and can operate very effectively in small teams. Whereas in a civilian company, you can find that there's a lot of inefficiencies because people don't operate very effectively in small teams because of where that control is held. And that comes back to a lot of what you talk about how you're interested in my thoughts around building teams and building high performing teams. A lot of it comes around that learning from the military about how to build a structure and how to give people the flexibility to work within that structure so they can be as good as they can possibly be without, you know, going to a place where they start to operate in areas where they don't know about, or they're dangerous.
So is it things like, you know, trying to eliminate, you know, inefficiencies like, you know, a bureaucracy, you know, for example, is that kind of what the military doesn't have. It's kind of that there is obviously always kind of a leaders within these smaller groups, but you know, there's the ability to kind of eliminate that kind of hierarchical structure. Is that part of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's always bureaucracy anywhere you go. But if you've got a well-defined structure, you can operate within, and everybody understands how it works. You can operate very effectively within that structure and that bureaucracy, and you know what you need to do in order to get things done. Where your bureaucracy is a little bit convoluted or a little bit hierarchical, you know, it can sometimes be very difficult to find out how you get the answer, especially in some of the large organizations. Sometimes it's very difficult to find an answer. When it comes to, you know, bureaucracy, politics, you know, there's a lot more politics I find in a civilian organization. I mean, partly because, and that can be quite frustrating because you don't know what games and what the rules are, what the game is and what the rules are. And you find that partly because, you know, in the military, again, there is a structure, there is a hierarchy, you know how your career goes. Yes, of course, there is an element of politics because there's only a certain amount of jobs that you get the further up the chain you go. But you sort of know how your career progression goes. You know the rules and responsibilities. You know what people's jobs are. I think in civilian organizations, there's more opportunity to play things like politics because it's, you know, people don't know what the game is. People don't know what people's intents and motivations are. They don't necessarily know where the company is going, what the direction is, what people's motivations might be, in the same way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, that's actually something that, I really believe in as well, is kind of that clarity and being able to share an inherent vision from the high level up and being really transparent on what that is. I really believe that that's kind of a key effective, management tool that you can really use, effectively. And obviously I've spoke with a number of managers and leaders, CTOs and sort of the sort. And, they all kind of believe in that same idea that, you know, you have to be super transparent on the vision and what they're working towards. Because I think it is very easy to get stuck in a bubble on when you're working on a particular project or you're part of the parcel of a bigger outcome. It's really important to kind of share that vision. And obviously people approach that in a different way. But yeah, I still think that there isn't quite that openness about what a company is moving towards, and it can be convenient sometimes, I suppose, not to do that. I don't know, but
that's true. I think it can be convenient, but I also think that it comes down to having the right management and leadership skills in place in the people that you're expecting to pass the message down. Right. So your CEO, for example, he can stand there and he can do his town hall and he can go on the internet and make some good statements and people listen to them. But if that's as far as it gets, and you know, you don't have the quality of individuals who are not necessarily any fault of their own. This isn't a challenge against, you know, having bad people in places. This is sometimes you have people that just don't have those skills or haven't had the exposure to those skills that they need to fulfill, you know, the type of activities that the organizations might need in terms of the leadership. But if you haven't got people throughout the organization that are capable of taking a message and continuing to push that message down and to help people understand the role that they play within that message, the CEO might as well be talking about anything, because it's only when you get that leadership all the way through the organization so that that message is coming through and it's very transparent, it's very clear. But most importantly, it helps people understand the role that they play within the vision, because it's all well and good saying, right, this is the vision of the organization, big hand, small map type thing, you know, or it's all up in the cloud. If an employee at the bottom of the food chain is saying, well, I'm not quite sure what I do in that. So you've got to have that ability to translate that to help people understand. And then you get the buy-in. And once you've got the buy-in, of those individuals, then everyone's working in the same direction. So I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of it. One of the key skills that's needed, especially I think now, as you know, you look at the way that the, you know, we talk about millennials and we've talked about them to death to a certain extent, and it can be a little bit frustrating. But you look at the type of individuals that are coming into the workplace now, and how they are looking at their careers differently, and how they look at their role in organisations differently, and their career paths, and what they want to achieve out of organisations, and how they feel between the work relationship between the employer and the employee. It's very different, and it is changing over time. You know, the key is to, you know, a lot of people are asking the question is, you know, how do you engage with these people? You know, well, part of that is helping them understand how they, you know, how they fit in the organisation, and the communication and that transparency around a shared vision and a goal, so that they know how they fit. And building that relationship with your new employees is key. If they don't understand, and they don't see, and they can't buy into, then they are going to say thank you very much. I'll go and find somewhere else that will do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're so valuable as well, new employees. You know, I mean, they're such a great source of information. They have that kind of still have that fresh take and that external value add that, you know, sometimes can get lost after you spend, you know, a certain amount of time internally. You know, I think obviously that external feedback and kind of understanding, you know, from outside the rounds is so, so important that, you know, I think that, you know, from my experiences, the new employees that are such a tremendous source of information. And I think that's something that is potentially looked at as the other way around. It's like, we actually want to train you to do things our way. And that's not going to work anymore, I think, because now you talk about millennials, their awareness of the macro marketplace and what's available out there, you know, they're not concerned as much as potentially people were 20, 30 years ago. Yep. So, you know, you can't have that approach. You have to come in and allow them to kind of, you know, have that kind of thought leadership initially coming in on you know, their cultural definition of a good culture, a good place to work, and all these kind of you know, internal dynamics that we have to work out. So you know, I think that there's probably, that's the easiest starting point, and I think that something that probably a lot of organizations don't do enough of is when they first come in, you know, outside of the interview, it's really the onboarding process that has to be adapted and taken very seriously, and, you know, working from an HR perspective in an agile way. But that you know, that's certainly been my take on it, at least.
I think that's a fair take.
Great. I'm glad I got the approval there. That's the official approval. So if anyone asks now, and I make that statement, I have the backing. So it's completely validated. Yeah, I mean, we talked a bit earlier about it, but, you know, I'm from, you know, a tech startup background, really. So my experiences with kind of, I like to call them blank canvas projects, has been pretty much consistent throughout my career. I've always worked on things that don't exist and try and make it into something. You know, I've never really necessarily been on the optimization side that much, kind of get things to a point and then it's like, all right, hands off. But, you know, I look at something like executing on, you know, building a high performance team, if you want to call it that, you know, whether, or, you know, I suppose let's just call it that, working on building a high performance team. You know, it's not entirely a blank canvas project, because you already have the people there and you have to kind of, you know, build them. I'm sure there is a recruitment side of it as well. But when you look at starting a project like that, I suppose one, you know, the rationale for starting a project like that, I mean, obviously it sounds, you know, compelling, a high performance team. But I suppose starting with kind of the rationale and why, you know, an organization would decide to kind of make these moves and make everything into a high performance team. But one, the rationale. Two, when you actually go about it, how does it even start? And what are the kind of the fundamental things that you have to look at in order to get, you know, an optimized team, if you like?
So the rationale for having a high performance team is that you can do more with less. I think that's the fundamental rationale. You can be much more effective with a very efficient, smaller workforce. I mean, I always use an example. It's not one I've physically done, but it's hypothetically it makes sense. Is that, you know, if you've got a team of 10 individuals in your, you know, and I mean individuals as in they're doing their own thing, you're sort of letting them, you're giving them direction, and they're coming to you for everything they have to do, and they don't think for themselves, and it's just a classic, you know, management style of, you know, I'll tell you what to do, you've got 10 people working inefficiently, right? And they're probably frustrated because they want to have some responsibility. They want to be empowered, so they're frustrated. Half of them are probably looking for another job because they're dissatisfied. And you know, the other half are trying to do their best, but doing it in a most ineffective way. And this is generalization, by the way. This isn't specifics. This is a generalization of a team of 10. And that team's therefore probably only working at 75% efficiency, maybe even less. Whereas if you've got a high-performing team of that same 10 people, and they are engaged, they are empowered, they share a vision, they share a goal, they believe in what they're doing, and they have a great infrastructure and structure to support them, then they're probably going to be working effectively as a team of 20 or 15. So because they're going to be working longer, they're going to be working harder, they're going to be working autonomously, so they're going to be getting twice as much done as they were in the past. And you know, your manager is then effectively freed up to do the work that he's paid to do, rather than, you know, spending all his time telling others what to do. So you know, you just through that logic, you've gone from a good team that's performing at 75% of its effectiveness to a high performing team, not adding any numbers, but producing, you know, 50-100% more. And that's a great rationale for having a high performance team. And I have actually seen that effectively from my military background. You know, working with very high performing teams in the military gives you a good perspective of what you can achieve with limited resources.
I suppose it's like a lean operation, essentially. Like if you're lean methodology, agile methodology, it's quite similar to that, but you know, obviously in the context of HR by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it is. But it's not lean for the sake of being lean. Because in a way, it's not creating high performance teams because you want a high performing team. It's actually creating high performance teams because you want to give people the best opportunity to be successful, right? So everybody should be trying to create high performing teams. Shouldn't suddenly just say, right, we're now going to be a high performance culture. You should always try to be a high performance culture in the way you treat your employees. It's how you can be a high performance culture because you use technology and you can use better systems and better processes and that sort of stuff. That's your lean methodology. But when it comes to people, it's about how you treat them, how you engage with them, how you empower them, how you train them, how you give them the ability to make smart, timely decisions within a framework that allows them to operate freely. You know, is it lean? No, it's just about taking an individual and saying, I'm going to make you the best that I can. How do I do that? And if you build your team with that framework and that goal in mind, then you're going to have a high performing team because everyone's going to want to work for you. People want to work for managers who give them the best opportunity to be successful.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think you're always like, I'm even coming at it from that approach, I suppose, and it's so tempting to approach people the way you would approach like a business solution, right? But you just can't, can you? But it is, you know, for someone like me with kind of a business background, it's always tempting to kind of approach things that way. But you have to, you know, it's interesting what you're saying, but it's so true and easily forgotten, as I've just proven. But it really is putting the people first and kind of working with them to get the best out of them. There is no, you know, it's agile and it in a sense, but.
Well, it comes back to this point about the leadership of the management. If you have high quality leadership management, then you can achieve this, because good leaders and managers know that, you know, you have to be agile. There's no one person. Everybody's different. Everybody needs to be treated differently. Everybody has different buttons they press. Everybody has different reasons for doing things, and they have different styles and different personalities. And if you are, you know, and good leaders and good managers understand the importance of that, and therefore how to get the best out of that. And if you can, get the best out of it, that's when you start to get your high performing teams. So high performing teams need high performing leaders to start with. You can't just say, you can't just fill a team full of stars. And this has been proven too. You go out there and you can recruit the best team in the world. You can get, you know, graduates from Cambridge with first class honors degrees, and you can all stick them all in a room, and in theory, it should be the best team ever. If the leadership and management surrounding that team is poor, then that team will be massively dysfunctional. But you can take a team of, you know, good, well-educated individuals who are not, you know, first-class graduates by any stretch of imagination, and you surround them with a fantastic framework of strong leadership management, they can knock it out of the park.
Yeah, I massively, massively, massively agree with that. It's so underrated, and it's interesting that, you know, it's not approached from that way for a lot of organizations. Like I say, they look for the people with skills to come in and, you know, have this dramatic impact. But, you know, the leadership is first, and the team's only as good as the culture and the environment and, you know, the direction in which it's kind of being propelled. So, you know, I would assume that, you know, someone like yourself, it's, you know, there's a strong emphasis on, you know, evolving leaders and working with leaders, you know, on a regular basis, I would thought.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? That's where you unlock the magic. I think, you know, and that's where I have to, you know, I can make a direct comparison between the military and the civilian world, and why perhaps civilian organizations aren't necessarily structured and or capable of fulfilling this as effectively as, let's say, in a military organization, is that in the military, you are often promoted because of you have the right leadership skills to assume the next role. Okay, it's not necessarily about your technical competencies. It's about, do you have this? Are you capable at leadership and management to be able to take the next promotional step to the next rank? And if you're not, then we need to give you training to do so. And training is very expensive, and it's extremely time consuming. Whereas if you look at certainly the civilian organizations that I've been working in, and that's very limited into the insurance industry, I get, but if you take a look at that, a lot of people are promoted because of their technical competencies. Oh, you're an excellent risk manager. I'm just going to make you a risk manager. Or you're the best underwriter we have. I'm going to make you the lead underwriter. Same in broking. You know, it's, if you are, you know, so you're being promoted for your technical ability, and then what companies then try to do afterwards is backfill their management and leadership. At which point it might be a little bit too late. So you've got people out there who are technically fantastic at what they do, but they don't have the skills at the depth of knowledge that it takes to necessarily then build an effective team. And what you sometimes find is those people then fail. And people say, well, that doesn't make any sense. This guy was a superstar. He was our best underwriter, and now he's failed and he's left. And that might be because he's been put into a position of where he cannot fulfill the requirements because he doesn't have that skill base. You know, whilst we continue to promote people based around their technical skills, you're always going to get that issue. So that need to incorporate really high quality leadership management from an early age and from a low level in the organization can really help, because it takes time and it takes practice, and you have to be able to practice, you know, leadership management skills in a relatively risk-free environment, because they're like any skill. You know, if you have to be able to make mistakes, And, you know, you don't want to be making your first leadership mistake in a very high pressure, in a very high pressure environment.
Yeah. It's something we talk about quite a lot because, you know, in IT, there's always a little bit more of a resistance to go into these leadership roles. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, really talented technical people, you know, really resist going into kind of these management positions. And they do inevitably have to do that, obviously, to progress their careers. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there are organizations that are working to give them kind of alternative paths so they don't have to necessarily do that. But, you know, it's still the case quite a lot. And obviously they're just kind of thrown into things and kind of expected to just, you know, manage effectively because they're, you know, particularly talented at, you know, the development skills or whatever the case may be. You know, and it is a completely different role. So, you know, the value in someone like such as yourself is just, you know, so impactful in those particular scenarios to be that kind of guidance for someone, you know, in that position where, you know, let's face it, it's a completely different skill set.
It is. And you need to learn it and you need to practice it, you know. You can, and this is the other thing, you can go on a course, or you can read a book. You know, there are lots of books out there about great leadership and great management techniques, but you've got to then be able to go and practice it. You've got to be able to go and take what you've learned and do it within an environment that allows you the freedom to do that. But like I said, it has to be, to a certain extent, it has to be an element of, you know, a learning culture put around that so that people can take a risk and make a mistake. But we are beholden to the shareholders. That's the problem. And we're beholden to, you know, making money and being as effective and efficient as you can be. And sometimes mistakes are less tolerated now, which is a shame.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's a really nice way of thinking about things. And, you know, I think when people are in an environment where they know that kind of failure is okay, that, you know, two things happen. One thing is that obviously they relax massively, you know, and the second thing is, I think it does help the creative thought, the confidence and all the rest of it to know that, like, you know, nothing bad's going to happen if you make mistakes. We are people at the end of the day and we do make mistakes. And, you know, I think that's where a lot of the problems come in, is where people make mistakes and they try and hide behind it instead of just kind of saying, you know, I actually made a mistake here. Well, how can we work to make sure that we don't make that mistake again, you know, from a management perspective. Yeah. But it's something that it's not kind of bred in corporate to be okay to do that. But it's fascinating
it goes back to that earlier point about, you know, politics and bureaucracy, and, you know, you're worried that the next, you know, that somebody else is going to get that opportunity because you've made a mistake. You know, it's about building the right culture. A lot of it is about having the right culture. And there are a lot of organizations, I'm sure, that do this fantastically well. And we need to learn from those. You know, that there are, you know, having a culture where, you know, where it's all inclusive. And I'm not talking about happy clappy when everybody's, you know, walking around and, you know, you've got everything that an employee could possibly want. You know, it's, you know, it's a difficult thing to say. There's a very strong, it has to be a balance between the employer and the employee. And, you know, we are ultimately still running businesses and trying to make money for, you know, whatever reason. But we still have to think that in order to get the best out of people, people have to operate in the best environment, and they have to have the best opportunity to be successful. And part of that means that they have to have the best, that they have to have an opportunity to learn and therefore to make a mistake.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. Stuart, I'm conscious of time here, mate. I think we covered quite a lot, actually, didn't we? In 35 minutes. But I think we'll kind of close things down there. But I just wanted to say that, you know, this was, you know, it was really informative for me. It's really made me think about a couple of different things. So, you know, a big thank you for kind of taking the time and sharing with us today.
No, it's my pleasure. Happy to help.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud. Or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.